And I supposed to look into this thing.
Yeah, you're fine.
Or look at you, or look at
yeah,
you.
Yeah, anyone. Yeah, well, just a conversation. Okay. So my name is Jordy Izzard, and I'm an alumni relations officer at SAIS, and I'm here with Ruth Swanson, who's the director of development at SAIS. And today's date is June 8th, 2011. And we are here with Ken Gunther, who's from the SAIS class of 1959 and has graciously offered to give us his time in a conversation. So thanks so much for being with us today. And we'll just start again with where, you know, what we discussed, which is what originally brought you to SAIS?
Jordy, Ruth, great to be here. Mm-hmm. Very neat project. Okay, what brought me to SAIS? We're looking at a different time and a different age. We're looking more than 50 years ago. And I went to a feeder university, so to speak, that had just inaugurated a non-Western civilizations program. Mm-hmm. And I was a key student of the non-Western civilizations program, which was focusing on Asia, Southeast Asia, and South Asia. And one of the professors at this University of Rochester non-Western Civilizations program had a relationship with SAIS. I worked with him when he was writing a book on Japan way back then, and Japan emerging from the Second World War. And he acquainted me with SAIS, opened the door to SAIS, and suggested I go to SAIS. And when I said yes, he got me into SAIS with a very nice fellowship.
That's great. That's great. And we were so glad to have you at SAIS. And when you were here, tell us about some of the memories you had in 1958-59.
It was a very different world, and reflecting a very different world, it was a very different SAIS. I mean, SAIS was in a former girls' school on Florida Avenue. It was a very small school. And the library was the former women's gymnasium, and you still had the sweet aroma of sneaks in the library. It was before the computer age, so it was lecture, reading, taking notes, and different from today again. We lived in the classrooms were in a building next door and on the first floor, and we lived happily ever after together on the second floor in rooms, dormitory style rooms, two people in each room. No bathrooms in the room. There was a one or two common bathrooms. I can't remember, there were women in our class, but I don't remember women living in the dormitory, which is, again, a very, very different world. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember any professors when you were there?
Yes.
Stood out for you?
It's a very good historical question, too. One of the most significant professors, and also one of the most eccentric and erratic, was Paul M.A. Linebarger. And Linebarger was the professor over China, Taiwan, Asia. He had a glass eye. And now and then he would take his glass eye out and roll it down the table at an offending student.
Did you ever have it rolled to you?
I was never an offending student, obviously. He wrote a book a year on China, Taiwan. He was tied into some way or another with the Kuomintang government that had gone to Taiwan after the Red Chinese had taken over China in January 1949. And after he wrote his book a year, he'd take us to the Peking Duck restaurant. And that's where I had my first Peking duck, let alone my first excellent, excellent Chinese food.
Is that in Virginia?
It used to be off Connecticut Avenue, uh-huh. Just on Connecticut Avenue, just down from Chevy Chase Circle.
Mm-hmm. And does it still exist?
No, it does not.
Okay.
But Peking duck definitely does exist.
Yes.
And I think the best Peking duck restaurant in the Washington area now is in Virginia.
I've been there.
Okay, language. I was studying Indonesian. At that time, their Southeast Asian history, Southeast Asia program was still in the formation stage, and they were looking at Yogyakarta, Indonesia, and they were also looking at Rangoon, Burma. They had a little center in Yogyakarta, not as ambitious as the center, Rangoon Hopkins Center for Southeast Asian Studies in Burma, which opened in 1954, before I came here. But someone from the Indonesian embassy came to SAIS. We had Indonesian lessons every morning at 7 o'clock. There was a group of about six, seven of us diligently studying Indonesian. One time we went to the Indonesian embassy, seven of us klutzes, and did the Indonesian candle dance, which is a very graceful, gracious dance, except when we were doing it. But it tried to tie you into the culture. And then the key moment for me was the dean who had an interest in Southeast Asia and Burma, Dean Thayer, invited me to go to have dinner with him, with the Burmese ambassador. And the Burmese embassy is right down the street across Connecticut Avenue from here. And we had dinner with the Burmese ambassador, and Dean Thayer indicated after the dinner that I was selected for to help staff out the Rangoon Hopkins Center for Southeast Asian Studies.
Terrific.
And the Rangoon Hopkins Center had a senior professor, William Johnstone, who lived on campus. And two SAIS students were staffing him out, helping to staff him out. We were working at the University of Rangoon. We were running a library at the University of Rangoon and doing research. We didn't know it then, but it was for one of the American intelligence services, which I found out since the fact, helped fund the Rangoon Hopkins Center. Other professors, there's a Professor Phillips, who was very, very good in economics. Isaiah Frank, I believe, was there, even way back then, again, economics. And that's about it.
That's terrific. You did a lot while you were here. And I'd love to hear a little bit about your career, actually.
One other thing. I mean,
sure.
You now have a very neat Rangoon Hopkins Center. Which I last visited when I was coming back from Burma in 1959. At that time, there were three Italian students among this very, very small student body. All three went on to have a very distinguished career in the Italian Foreign Service. I believe they had their first year in Bologna and then came to Hopkins, Washington for their second year. Mm-hmm. And this was, we also had an Indonesian student who was from the Indonesian royalty. We had a Finnish student, someone called Klaus Tornud, who went on to become the Finnish ambassador to the United Nations. And so you had this small student body, but already back then, this very, very interesting international mix. And really, I think I learned as much from the Italian graduate students than I almost learned from the professors. I had my roommate was a young man called Samir Zoghbi, an Egyptian, a Copt. And Samir's father ran the Suez Canal. And if you will remember, and I doubt that you do, that the major policy events of 1956 was the nationalization of the Suez Canal by President Nasser, who was one of the young military leaders of Egypt. Okay, my roommate essentially fled Egypt after the Suez Canal was nationalized. His father was thrown out. He was a Coptic Christian. And I remember he came, and his sole financial resources were $4,000 in cash. And that's how he funded his time at SAIS. The other major event in 1956 was that the Russians invaded Hungary. At that time you didn't have an Arab Spring. At that time you had an Eastern European Spring just beginning to break out, and the Russian military forces were sent into Hungary, and there was a slaughter of the students in Hungary by the Russians and the security system. So you had the nationalization of the Suez Canal. Okay, why was the Suez Canal nationalized? The U.S. and the British and the French would not finance the construction of the Aswan Dam, which was the pinnacle, the monumental hoped-for achievement of Nasser. So Nasser, in retaliation, nationalized the Suez Canal. The Israelis, the British, and the French invaded, and believe it or not, during the administration of President Eisenhower, the U.S. did not support the invasion, to try to take back of the Suez Canal. And that was sort of the policy framework the conflict with Russia, anti-colonialism, and then going to Burma. And the role of the Russians in Burma, the role of the Chinese in Burma, and Burma, in a way, was all about China. It just came out of the Korean War. The U.S. fought China in the Korean War. We go to Burma, Rangoon Hopkins Center, and the foundation block of Burmese foreign policy is we don't want to become another Korea. Okay, and why would Burma have concerns, worries about becoming another Korea? When Mao came in 1949, and the Kuomintang, Chiang Kai-shek went out to Taiwan, there was a significant number of Burmese who fled into northern Burma, into the Golden Triangle. And when the Chinese misbehaved, China was closed. Red China was closed. You could just look and imagine what was there. Eisenhower would threaten the Chinese that we're going to unleash the Kuomintang troops in northern Burma and send them into the soft underbelly of the Yunnan province in China.
Fascinating. Wow. That all just came out so like it was yesterday for you. That's great.
Yeah, it was. At your guy's age, that is yesterday, yes.
Oh, that's terrific. Great memory of events going on then. And tell us a little bit about when you left SAIS. What did you do when you first left, and how did your career evolve?
Okay, I mentioned the Non-Western Civilizations Program of the University of Rochester, and under Vera Michaels Dean, India. I worked for a professor who was writing a book on Japan, and I bumped into a very unusual associate professor who had just joined the faculty of the history department of the University of Rochester. Mm-hmm. So this would be 56, 57. His name was Harry J. Benda. And Harry J. Benda was a Czech Jew. When the Germans moved into Czechoslovakia, he fled to Holland. The Germans fled into Holland. He fled to Indonesia, which was a former Dutch colony. Mm-hmm. He landed in Indonesia just in time to be interned in a Japanese prison camp with the ruling elite of Indonesia. And he spent 4 years in a Japanese prison camp. And he came out of the prison camp knowing Dutch, German, English, Indonesian, Japanese. And so he became one of the leading scholars in Southeast Asian history. His thesis was the Japanese occupation of Indonesia, focusing on Japanese occupation of Southeast Asia, focusing on Indonesia. His book was The Crescent and the Rising Sun. We still could learn a lot from the Crescent and the Rising Sun, how occupiers treat an Arab country, Indonesia's Arab. I became sort of a disciple of Harry Benda. And while I was in Burma, he went to Yale. I came home from Burma here. And then there was the choice of taking a PhD or starting a PhD program at Hopkins, not SAIS Hopkins. or going to Yale with Dr. Benda. And I decided to go to Yale with Dr. Benda. So I was at Yale in their Southeast Asian history, program, Japanese occupation of Southeast Asia, focusing on Burma from 58 to 59. Then I decided in my wisdom that I really wasn't an academic. I wanted to be more actively engaged. So I started down the path to get in the Foreign Service, and I joined the Foreign Service after some way stops in 1965.
Mm-hmm. And where did the Foreign Service take you?
Okay, the Foreign Service, they looked at me and said that he knows too much about Southeast Asia. We got to broaden this guy. And so they broadened me and they sent me to Chile. Okay. And I was in Chile from 1966 to 1968. And in Chile, I was the control officer for some interesting people. I was a control officer for President candidate Nixon, who was refurbishing his foreign policy credentials and visiting 67 countries before running for the presidency. In 68, November 1968, I spent a morning with the soon-to-be president, and I, more significantly, in retrospect, I was the control officer for 3 days for Senator Jacob K. Javits, Republican of New York, senior member of the Senate Minority Party, senior member of the Foreign Relations Committee. And I came back from Chile in 68. Had an absolutely cruddy job in the Department of State, 68-69, and the senator called and said there were, he had two openings, staff head of Joint Economic Committee or person who was economic and finance on his personal staff and also supervising his JEC staff. So I left the Department of State. I took my beautiful diplomatic passport. At that time, you went to a room in the basement of the Department of State, and there was this very old crone with a big pair of scissors. And they took the three diplomatic passports, my wife, my daughter, and myself, and she cut the edges off the diplomatic passport and handed them back with the edges cut off, which I still have as a treasured memory. I left State almost forever. For the senator from New York on the Hill.
Mm-hmm. And that was in 68 or 9?
That was 1969, correct.
Nine, uh-huh. Correct. And then where did that take you?
I also did his Latin American work, his banking work, and his financial work, and there's another chapter. It took me to a presidential appointment, and I was the alternate U.S. Executive Director of the Inter-American Development Bank. And there was a key happening at the bank while I was at the bank. At the bank from 73 to 1974. I left Javits' staff in 73. Recall I was in Chile earlier. I was not in Chile in the election of 1970 when the far leftist candidate won, Salvador Allende, and he had the massive swing to the left in Chile. The story that is not told is that it was a three-candidate race in 1970. You had Allende on the far left, you had the Christian Democrat Radomiro Tomic in the center, and you had someone called Alessandri in the right, and Nixon, who had visited Chile in 1967, knew Chile. And for whatever reason, Nixon, Kissinger decided to dump the candidate of the center and go with the candidate of the right. And the candidate of the right lost narrowly, so the candidate of the left, Allende, won in 1970. Mm-hmm. So we had this enormous swing to the left, a swing to the left that was very antithetical to U.S. goals and foreign policy. We were very much against the Allende regime at the Inter-American Development Bank. As a U.S. director, my job was to make sure that not a penny went to Chile. And there was one very, very dramatic moment, September 11th, 1973. The board was meeting in a pre-decisional meeting on the loan that we are going to grant on Thursday. And the president of the bank never came into a board meeting when we met on Wednesday. The board met on Wednesday and Thursday. That Wednesday, September 11th, 1973, the president of the bank came into the boardroom and indicated that there was a coup in Chile. President Allende had died in the coup, at which time the Chilean alternate executive director representing Chile threw himself on the board table, hollered, screamed, and sobbed. And then the bank, the next week, took the decision to change the annual meeting from where it was going to be held in April 1974, to hold it in Santiago. And the bank also began moving to process two ill-conceived loans to Chile that would be approved at the board meeting in Santiago in April 1974. I signed the loans in Santiago to the new Chilean military junta in April 1974. The head of delegation was the Secretary of Treasury, George Shultz. George Shultz was the head of the delegation. And shame on us all. We were in a major auditorium in Santiago for the annual meeting, and the Chilean junta walked in. Pinochet was the sort of the de facto head of the junta, but the junta was four military men. Two of the four were goose-stepping. And the U.S. delegation, led by Secretary Shultz of the Treasury Department, applauded that these four people goose-stepped in. We also met, just in passing, socially Pinochet.
Wow, fascinating.
And then I decided there was enough of the Inter-American Development Bank. Interesting about the Inter-American, just a very, very short little footnote. The Inter-American Development Bank, the U.S. role in the Inter-American Development Bank is always a power play between the Secretary of Treasury and the Secretary of State. And if the Secretary of State back then decided to, he wanted to step in, I mean, Kissinger would beat as Secretary of State would beat any Secretary of Treasury on a major policy issue. Most of the time, things didn't get to the Kissinger level, and that's how the Treasury controlled the IDB, as they controlled the IMF and the World Bank. And I'm sure that continues until today. Okay. I had left Senator Javits, as indicated, in 1973, went to the Inter-American Development Bank as U.S. Director, 73-74. The trade bill of 1970, what became the trade bill of 1974, was pending. Big trade bill, one of the biggest trade bills that ever conceived and passed. And so I was called to the White House to get the Trade Act of 1974 passed. Mm-hmm. And when I got the trade, the Trade Act of 74 passed, and again, luck, fate, which are major business in everybody's life.
Talent,
luck, fate, luck. SCR, I was the ranking, I was brought in as the ranking civil servant, even though it was obviously a political appointee. Really charged for getting the Trade Act 1974 passed, which contained Jackson Vanik, which is still alive, a major issue with the Russians, as you may know. The ambassador and the deputy, the SCR and the deputy SDR resigned right after, well, the SCR resigned. The deputy SDR got in a power struggle with the assistant to the president because he wanted to become STR. Problem was, the Ford White House, he was a Democrat. On the assistant to the president, someone called L. William Seedman, assistant to President Ford, listened to the deputy out, and the deputy said, okay, the multilateral trade negotiations are kicking off. Either appoint me STR or I resign, and this puts the whole thing in a mess. And the assistant to the president, William Seidman, said goodbye. And I became the acting SDR. And was the acting SDR for 6 months. This would be 74, 75. And then went for a permanent ambassadorship in Geneva, which I had, given Javits' support, Barbara Conable of New York's support, and other support, and having and the rest. And then the head of White House personnel decided he wanted a job for himself. And so Ford's director of White House personnel, someone called Bill Walker, did get the job, the deputy in Geneva. I had to leave SCR, and so I went to someone I had met when I was with Javits, who was the chairman of the Federal Reserve System. I went into the Federal Reserve in 1975. Mm-hmm. Worked for the chairman. Burns was chairman for 2.5 years, and his term was up, and then a new chair, Carter was elected, a new chairman came in. He only stayed 18 months before becoming Secretary of Treasury, and I stayed through him, couldn't stand him, had announced my resignation, and then Paul Volcker came in, who was a dear friend of mine. I gather Volcker has talked here various times, still getting appointments, had just been appointed to a body over systemic risk and too big to fail. Volcker was at the New York Fed, and I ended up working with Volcker. It delayed my resignation until we got the Monetary Control Act of 1980 passed, the first major deregulation piece of regulation. And I was 44. I was looking around. Reagan was Carter was in the White House. Reagan was coming in. I was a Javits Republican, and I decided this is probably a good time to leave the government. I left the government and went in the private sector, and was in banking for the rest of my career.
Oh wow! Where were you? In what part of banking?
Surprisingly enough, I was the assistant to the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve System. And to get the Monetary Control Act of 1980 passed, it was called the Depository Institution Deregulation and Monetary Control Act of 1980, we had to split the banking industry. So I worked with this little sliver group representing community banks, and we decided that this group, we could use this group to split the banking industry, and by splitting the banking industry and get some banking support for the pending legislation, that would be enough to pass the legislation. It ended up being being correct. If you have any history of Dodd-Frank, same tactic was used, same group was used to split the banking industry, community banks against the money center banks. I went with the trade association representing community banks, the group we used to split the industry. And I stayed there through 2004. And ended up in 2004 getting the Lifetime Achievement Award of the American Banker.
Congratulations.
At the same time that Jamie Dixon got the Lifetime Achievement Award from of J.P. Morgan
Terrific.
Chase.
Congratulations. Yeah.
So I was in banking.
That's great. And you've since been retired?
I've been retired, serving on boards, doing nonprofit work, which is fairly easy to do. If you don't demand a salary, there's plenty of jobs available and interesting stuff to do.
Mm-hmm. And I've been writing. What organizations are you currently affiliated then?
I was the chairman of something called the Washington Campus, which was set up by L. William Seidman, who was the assistant to President Ford, who I worked for when I was acting SDR. We worked with 18 universities who are running MBA programs, a little segment component of an MBA program, bringing people to Washington to teach them how Washington really, really works. Mm-hmm. I work for AARP on money management. As people get older, more and more lose the capability to handle money. So there's a massive growing need for the helping the elderly, the elderly poor manage money. And then I've been writing a blog for Sheshanov Pratt on financial matters.
Mm-hmm. That's terrific.
Yeah, well, it's fun.
Yeah, I guess the last thing we'd like to hear is a little bit about goodness with the long list of accomplishments you've had in your career. What advice might you have for current students today at Zeiss?
I would say first, congratulations.
Aww.
I think you're starting down the path correctly. And it's a fascinating path, and it's an interesting path, and will continue to be fascinating and interesting in the stride of where the world is going. Okay, starting down that path with that foundation, with that academic foundation, I think the other thing that is evident in my career, you don't have to stay with it. It opens up all kinds of other doors. And you got a very, very long life ahead. And use that foundation. And the ball is going to bounce. And the ball is going to bounce in ways you really don't know. But I think you'll have the foundation to continue to be able to play tennis, regardless of where the ball bounces. And it was funny, coming here today, I was coming down my subway, and I bumped into a woman who knows me, who's there with her niece. And taking her niece to the Air and Space Museum. She's the head of the Gandhi Center. She's not Zeiss, but I still have a connection with the Gandhi Center. Why? Because Zeiss corrupted me in terms of Asia, Southeast Asian studies, Buddhism, different cultures. And still today, 50 years out, culturally, I still connect into the Gandhi Center and Indian music. So you have the academic path, but you also have the cultural path. And in terms of, okay, you have the academic path that you're on. It will take you in a certain direction. But you're going to go elsewhere. And you really don't quite know when or where, and the odds favor you're going to have more bounces of the ball than even I had. And you're going to have a longer working life and a longer working career. So be flexible, learn. Yes, go to Nanking. Yes, go to the Bologna Center or where else you can go and get that under your belt as one of your 2 years. I think it's a little bit of a waste if you don't. Not waste is a strong word, a missed opportunity in a way, and then go for it.
Mm-hmm. Terrific. Thank you so much for your time.
Well, super.
Yeah, thanks. We really appreciate it, and we've learned a lot today. Thanks.
No, it's fun.
So when you learned that the...